Well, we've reached the halfway point in this program celebrating the music of James B. Johnson. We're shifting from the 1920s to a very different period in Johnson's career.
Yes. In 1940, Johnson had had a stroke. By 1942, he had recovered, but his style was somewhat different. His fingering is perhaps a little less clean, didn't swing as hard as he had previously. But still, within the jazz piano community, he was still an extremely formidable pianist.
Why did you choose this particular Caprice Rag?
Johnson was said to have recorded this in 1923, but at the time it was never issued. And it's clear that Johnson kept these rags in his repertoire towards the end of his life, and it really demonstrates his roots in ragtime. Now, keep in mind that this is not the way that a ragtime pianist would play Caprice Rag. Johnson plays it at breakneck tempo, and he also improvises extensively throughout the composition, as well as adding multiple blue notes throughout the performance, rather appropriate given the label that he is recording for. So again, this really is an excellent demonstration of Johnson's stride style applied to a ragtime composition.
And stride itself having evolved from ragtime piano style. The difference between rag and stride.
The stride bass line is characterized by alternating single notes or tenths with chords towards middle C. And there's a certain tension and release between the right and the left hand. So the conventional way of notating music is not sufficient for really capturing the rhythmic subtleties of stride. And further, whereas ragtime is syncopated, as is jazz and therefore stride piano swings. One can clearly hear the difference between a Scott Joplin rag and a James P. Johnson stomp or stride piece. Ragtime is based not only on the classics, but also on marches of the time. More of a march tempo is, I think, a more accurate description of the rhythm of ragtime. Again, though ragged, it does not swing.
In that set, we've shifted from the first to the second part of this program, which is the 1940s. What was that we just heard?
This was a piano solo that Johnson recorded for the Blue Note label in 1943 called Gut Stomp. The composer credit is also shared with Willie the Lion Smith. And it's a wonderful example of Johnson's slow stride style.
Well, among the changes in Johnson's career in the 40s is the rise of small independent labels and the jazz revival, those who are interested in going back and finding the roots and the origins of this music.
Yeah, that's right. And Johnson certainly benefited from this. Two of the best known probably were Commodore and Blue Note. Blue Note was founded by German immigrants who absolutely loved the music. It was Alfred Lion and Francis Wolfe. They were famous for having just really laid back, wonderful recording sessions, great food, relaxed atmosphere. And for the most part, they let the musicians program whatever selections it was they wanted to play. They also distinguished themselves by issuing 12-inch as opposed to 10-inch 78s, which allowed the musicians to really stretch out and give a tune its full performance. Freed from these constraints, again, you really hear Johnson, especially in his band side, just stretch out and give some terrific performances. Johnson recorded solo under his own name for Blue Note with a band of his for Blue Note, as well as with groups led by the trumpeter Sidney DeParis and also by the clarinetist Edmund Hall. The tune that we're about to hear is yet another example of Johnson's take on Boogie Woogie, recorded with Edmund Hall's Blue Note Jazzmen, called Blue Note Boogie, which, to give ourselves somewhat of a modern connection, was used recently in the soundtrack of the movie The Majestic, starring Jim Carrey. Thank you.
Johnson's collaborations with younger musicians, particularly the White Dixielanders, really got rolling by the mid-40s.
Yes, at this time, many of the racial barriers that existed in
the recording industry and the society as a whole.
That's right. For instance, in 1938, Johnson began to play at the Cafe Society downtown, which was founded by Barney Josephson, who was a well-known restaurateur and promoter of the music well into the 1970s and 80s. But he was one of the first of the impresarios to offer a venue for integrated not only performances, but also audiences. For instance, the Cotton Club in the 1920s featured black bands, but it served only a white clientele.
Johnson was collaborating with the Condon Gang, Pee Wee Russell, Tea Garden, Bud Freeman, that crowd.
Yes.
He was being invited on to radio shows like Rudy Blesch, This Is Jazz.
Right, and as well as doing Eddie Condon's town hall concerts.
I think the Yank Lawson Jazz Band is another example of this.
One of Johnson's best band recordings from this era was done in 1943, recorded by Bob Teal, another one of the producers who pioneered racial integration in his sessions.
And it's When I Grow Too Old to Dream, which is, I think, a terrific and not that well appreciated tune.
Right, by Rodgers and Hammerstein. Thank you.
I know that you know the Rod Class Quartet. What can you tell us about that 1944 recording of Johnson?
This was a small group, and it was around the time that Johnson was playing intermission piano at a club called the Pied Piper in Greenwich Village. It was active for less than a year, but featured Johnson as the intermission pianist with a group that included the trumpeter Max Kaminsky, the clarinetist Rod Kless, Willie the Lion Smith was the band pianist.
Involved with, it's still really in its formative stages, isn't it, the James P. Johnson Foundation?
Yes. It's located in Riverside, California, where the majority of the Johnson family lives today. And it can be found at www.jamespjohnson.org. The foundation is dedicated to preserving the papers and music of James P. Johnson, making these materials available to the public and to scholars who are interested in doing research on his life, and then using the proceeds to support arts programs for underprivileged children in the Riverside area. We are currently in the process of negotiating a permanent repository for the Johnson papers. And Johnson is of such stature within the world of jazz that the two leading candidates for this right now are the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, our country's National Museum, and the Institute for Jazz Studies in New Brunswick, New Jersey.
Mark, there are a couple of other people that we want to mention who supplied some of the materials and background for this.
Yes, supplied materials provided inspiration and education over the years. This will unfortunately have to be an incomplete list, but I would like to begin with, first of all, Rudy Blesch, who William Bolcom has said was the person who first got us all thinking about ragtime in the first place. Bob Hilbert, who was the discographer of James P. Johnson in his very well-done biography, A Case of Mistaken Identity, The Life and Music of James P. Johnson by Scott Brown. Barry Glover, James P. Johnson's grandson and the president of the James P. Johnson Foundation, as well as all of the members of the Johnson family, especially Johnson's daughters, Arceola and Lily Mae.
In these programs, we've been sharing the symphonic music, the piano stride, the band jazz, the American standards, that all came from this remarkable and fertile mind of James P. Johnson. What have we discovered in the big picture of where Johnson fits into American music?
Again, any jazz pianist active today can trace his lineage back to James P. Johnson. He was the pianist who was most responsible for the evolution of ragtime into jazz piano, and the rhythmic devices and riffs and swing that Johnson introduced into the music still exists today. ¶¶ Johnson is coming from a jazz tradition, and with his continuing education in the 1930s and 40s in the realm of classical music, was trying to leave his own distinctive brand on classical music from the jazz tradition. Now, one may argue whether or not he needed to do this within the realm of European concert music. It would have been equally valid, I think, if he continued to evolve the stride piano style in a more linear manner. Again, he was not comfortable with the prevailing constraints of the day, both in racial and ethnic terms, and how these were translated into musical terms. Again, he began his recording career recording for the Race series, sold mostly in black neighborhoods, for instance. And in the 1940s, we see him increasingly in the setting of, again, white Dixieland jazz and the concerts promoted by people like John Hammond and Rudy Blesch.
To conclude, we have a studio recording of James P. Johnson with Eddie Condon.
This is from 1946 and features Johnson in four wonderful solo choruses. And it's a terrific way to conclude this hour.
Mark Borowski, thank you so much for deepening our understanding and for your work with the James P. Johnson Foundation.
Dave, it's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you.